does it feel to be at another conference talking about psychedelic issues?
I'm just going to give that to you in case you need me.
The last conference I remember was 1965.
Really?
The International Conference of LSD Psychotherapy.
Yep.
There hasn't been any specifically psychedelic conferences and conferences focusing on psychedelic research that I remember some of them.
That is the thing, isn't it? I guess that's and more proof of the pudding that the psychedelic renaissance is upon us.
Yeah. Well, there have been occasionally symposia or something within conferences, maybe an afternoon. But nothing.
So this MAPS, it's the first one of its kind in the 21st century, perhaps. Yeah. Yeah. Were you at Basel in 2006? For Albert's?
Well, outside of the United States, in the Basel conference, the Albert Hofmann,
Yeah.
Those were great.
Really? Well, Stan, thank you for talking with us today. We're doing some short interviews with Reality Sandwich, which is a leading countercultural website on all matters. Thank you. You've got a very distinguished career. I'm thinking really you're almost one of the titans left of, your entire career, but it's been decades and decades of really fundamental work to really look at what the psychedelic experience is all about. Could you just maybe tell us a bit of the origins? Like, you started off in Czechoslovakia.
I was born in Prague, Czechoslovakia. I got my scientific training there, an MD degree from Charles University School of Medicine. And then later I got a PhD, which was called Doctor of Philosophy and Medicine, from the Czechoslovakian Academy of Sciences.
And what made you move towards psychedelic research? Because that happened early on in your career, didn't it?
Well, I originally wanted to work in animated movies, believe it or not.
Really?
Yeah, I love to draw, I love to paint.
Wow.
And I already, after I finished gymnasium, which is not gymnasium here, it's about physical exercise, but gymnasium in Europe is sort of parallel to high school.
Mm-hmm.
So I finished this gymnasium and I had my interview with a guy who was my hero, was a wonderful Czech artist who was doing animated movies, and I was accepted. I was supposed to start in the Prague Film Studios, and just at that time a friend of mine gave me introductory lectures to psychoanalysis by Freud.
Right.
And I started reading it in the evening, and I read through the night, and within several days I decided that this is what I'm going to do.
Right. So, but that was psychoanalytical. Was LSD on the scene then? Because Czechoslovakia had a research community.
This was later. I was a fourth year medical student when I started going to psychiatric clinic for, when people in medical studies, they choose their discipline, then you have the possibility of get some sort of an advanced training while you're still studying medicine.
Yep.
And so the man who was my preceptor got a supply of LSD from Sandhurst.
Right.
And
what was your first experience like with LSD yourself?
56. So very, very shortly, because they didn't sort of allow students to have it.
Wow.
So just very, very several weeks after I got my MD degree, I decided to take LSD. I was very fascinated by it. And it was actually not just LSD. I had to agree to be exposed to powerful stroboscopic light.
Right.
Because my teacher, my preceptor, was studying what's called entrainment or driving of brainwaves. And, if you can induce certain kinds of frequencies in the brainwaves. And he wanted to see how ingestion of LSD would change it.
Do you think, because that was a model that was used at the start, I remember in Harvard as well, and that's coming full circle again now, that the doctor and the patient shouldn't be separated. It's like you should go on the journey as well with the patient. You dose yourself as well.
I don't think that's coming back, no.
I know, MAPS is sponsoring the use of physicians and the practitioners taking MDMA, maybe not with the patient yet, but they're edging towards a model which may be more interactive.
I don't think so. I think we always believe that in order to work with psychedelics, you have to have personal experience. Otherwise, you would be like pre-adolescent consulting people on their sexual life or something like that. you really have to know what you are, what you're working with. But we never advocated that you should take it with the patient. With, you know, it's an opportunity for you to go deep, and if you have to sort of perform some task on the outside, it takes away from your own experience.
Sure. So you did a lot of
even
research.
Even in Lear, you know, Lear is the prison project. They were taking it to with the clients, and they found out that the one who was under the influence of psychedelics was not really the best therapist. So they were bringing a guy who was not the third person, who was sort of like supervising the whole thing.
So you did a lot of research with LSD and different altered states of mind, but then that closed down when it was made illegal in the in 66. The research continued to the early 70s. You were still doing some research.
Yeah, when I came in 67, so that project was the last surviving official project in Maryland Psychiatric Research Center.
And what do you think? There was like so many thousands of case studies done with LSD for, you know, different case studies, and all that knowledge seemed to be just discarded by the powers that be at the time.
Well, there was, for example, if you look at the study of complications, Sidney Cohen was one of the early, you know, pioneers, collected data from 25,000 sessions with mescaline and LSD.
Wow.
And wrote a paper on it, and the, you know, there was minimum complications, in terms of prolonged reactions, flashbacks, suicidal attempts, and so on. And not much was known about psychedelics then, but it was understood that if somebody takes it, somebody has to be with them, you know.
Sure.
And they were kept overnight, and then in the morning somebody checked how they were, and then before they went home, and the complications were absolutely minimal.
How did you, and I guess also the research community, feel when such legitimate work was being done with psychedelics as a medicinal tool, all those case studies we just mentioned, and yet because of the politics, did you feel betrayed by the science that didn't stand up for the science of it?
Well, it's just idiotic. It would be like having a bunch of teenagers breaking into an X-ray laboratory, starting playing with X-rays, and there would be headlines, you know, teenagers burned by X-rays, X-rays dangerous. You would outlaw Rentgen. When it's understood that it's a powerful tool and you have to know something about how to use it. So to outlaw psychedelics on the basis of what was happening when people were taking it completely without any kind of supervision, unknown dosages, unknown quality, and sort of use that as a basis of suppressing you know, scientific research was just bizarre.
I guess there's always an equal and opposite reaction to things. When that vacuum that was created by LSD disappearing, you moved into other modalities and you founded the holotropic breathwork model.
Yeah.
And that's been a very profound extra tool for people to alter their consciousness.
Yeah, well, it's amazing because, you know, it's very, very powerful, it's very simple, and it's unlikely that there would be any time soon speed limit for breathing, or
they can't ban breathing,
but you couldn't play music, and there's some question about touching, whether you can touch people or not, but we have taken it out of the professional area. We developed it at SLM, and we don't talk about patients, doctor patient. We don't talk about therapy. We talk about the self-exploration, you know, experiment in self-exploration. Group of people come together and they set their own rules. We're going to sit for each other, breathing, and you know, touching is okay.
And
but if you would do it, you know, as a doctor with patients and so on, then you run into problems even with touching.
Yeah. And so, do you think now that it seems like the MAPS conference here has been a focal point for the scientific community to almost come out of the closet again about psychedelics? You know, it's very upfront. There's some studies away all around the world with different chemicals that MAPS is sponsoring. There seems to be this psychedelic renaissance. I mean, do you think that, you know, it's taken so many decades to come full circle, but are you positive about where it's going now?
Well, you know, I'm somewhat ambivalent about this whole thing because on the one hand I'm excited that it's coming back. On the other hand, it's to a great extent repeating things that were already done.
Like where's the new ground?
Like we had, you know, this was a large cancer study that was very successful, and it was really time now to take it to the hospices and to the hospital and so on. So they might be repeating it, you know, with better sort of methodology and so on.
Do you think in some sense they are just going over old ground and repeating what's already been studied before?
Well, at least in this stage, you know. For example, the Johns Hopkins study is great, showing that psilocybin can induce mystical experiences, but that was the Good Friday experiment with Walter Behnke, you know. And, I mean, those of us who had the experiences, it's so obvious. I mean, why do you need to find out that, you know, scientific methodology to prove that?
Well, do you think then science should be also in the hands of the people, not just the doctors? Do they need that guidance from a elder figure, authority figure to guide them?
I think there are different ways of using psychedelics. One very legitimate one would be in a spiritual context. Mm-hmm. You know, there is a very, very good indication that this is a sacred technology of the sacred. It is something that induces mystical experiences and has been used for centuries by indigenous groups in, you know, South America and Mexico and Siberia and other places. So that's another legitimate use. I mean, to have rituals where the purpose is not healing, but inducing spiritual experiences.
What do you think?
It's really difficult to separate, because spiritual experiences themselves can be very healing.
Exactly. I guess there's a very much a boom at the moment with ayahuasca movement in the West, coming from indigenous South America, and they call ayahuasca the medicine, but it's outside the rigorous scientific academia of studying it, and it's just in the hands of people bridging with the shamans and curanderos. But as I say, it's still medicine.
And people, in pre-literate cultures learn how to use psychedelics very effectively, so you don't really have to have university education. But in our kind of culture, it becomes necessary.
Generally, what do you think is the brightest future you can imagine for psychedelics being a useful tool for humanity?
What would be the
brightest future, like the best path, you think, for the psychedelic community to travel?
Well, one of the things I would do is to create a network of centers where people who want that experiments for whatever reason, for spiritual purposes, for healing purposes, for artistic purposes, artistic inspiration, scientific inspiration, could go and have experiences with good substances, in a decent set and setting and so on, rather than going and having to do it in raves and so on. And you would have a situation where the material that would be accumulated could be used to promotion of our knowledge about the psyche and consciousness. Otherwise, you have a situation where now millions of people are taking it on their own, and the people who know least about it are the psychiatrists.
Genie's out of the bottle.
There are a lot of people in the subculture who, the counterculture, who use it reasonably, who really get to know much more about the psyche than the psychiatrists do, the psychologists. Mm. So because they have this powerful tool, it would be like, for example, an official academic community competing with people in the paraprofessional circles, and the people in paraprofessional circles would have the use of microscopes. So the universities, would have that advantage that the academic community could not match. No amount of education, because suddenly there's a tool that opens up dimensions that before were not available. And people who will not use it are going to have tremendous advantage.
Do you think we're ready as a culture for those dimensions, for like the shamanic realm of energy and multiple reality?
Well, I think the easiest area would be this therapeutic area, and within that, even certain groups of people. For example, it would be easier to get permission to work with terminal cancer patients than it would be to give training sessions to professionals.
It's ironic, isn't it? Because a healthy volunteer in the right age group could actually probably go deeper into the cycle experience.
Yeah, but the professional argumentation would be that you have a really serious reason, somebody.
What about the disenchantment from the natural world? Is that not serious enough?
Well, some of us see it that way, others don't, you know. So it was always easier to get, if you work with Skid Row alcoholics, if you work with narcotic drug addicts taken from prison, people dying of cancer, it was always easier to get the permission than, you know, working with people coming just for the experience, or,
but do you think
or even professionals coming for knowledge promoting there.
Do you think, though, that the psychedelic experience is a human birthright? It's open, its potential is there for everyone. Maybe not everyone is ready at the exact same time, but is it a human innate experience that we deserve?
I think it is. I think not only the birthright, but you know, I think it's also the propensity to have that, and also the desire to have that experience. It's a very powerful force in the psyche. So Andy Weil wrote that you know, the need to experience the transcendental dimension is more powerful than sex, which was so much emphasized, you know, by Freud. And if that's the case, if psychedelics can somehow relate to that profound human need, you know, to have a transcendental experience, then you get a pretty good idea how you could deal with the so-called abuse.
Mm.
So it sort of set a program like Just Say No would be silly.
Yeah.
You know, if sex is, let's say, less powerful than this transcendental impulse, can you imagine a program that would say, you know,
just say more.
A masturbation-free America, just say no.
Yeah.
You would not have a lot of
followers there, yeah.
Yeah. So the only way you could sort of combat masturbation is offer access to, you know, mature sexual experience. So the same way to combat the need to take psychedelics, the only thing would be you provide access to spiritual experience, you know, possibly the holotropic breathwork to move in that direction, because you can have spiritual experiences.
The God drive is stronger than the sex drive.
But just say no, just to take away the psychedelic tools and not offering anything.
Leaves it back to you.
Well,
thank you very much for your time, Stan. I really appreciate it. And I do think you are a titan of the psychedelic culture.
Oh, thank you.
Hey, you've done some amazing work. Nicholas, Sam, thank you for chatting. We're doing some video interviews for Reality Sandwich, which is a leading American countercultural website, if you know of it. And you've been a very important figure, I guess, in psychedelic history as one of the chemists that was instrumental in helping Albert Hoffman's problem child reach out to the world.
Mm-hmm.
How did you first get involved in that scene back in the 60s or early 70s?
Well, I was studying cultural revitalization movements under the banner of cultural anthropology, and I was also simultaneously studying yoga. And I left for Mexico and spent a month or two living with Maria Sabinas in her hut.
Wow.
And being initiated into the mushroom ceremony.
And what year was this?
I'm not really sure, 61 or 62.
Yep.
And so Maria and I had some very interesting conversations, although I could not speak Spanish and she couldn't either.
Yeah.
She could only speak Mazatecan and I could only speak English. But we started to communicate during the session in glossolalia.
Ah.
And I began to realize that there was a universal language that all life shared. And it was the DNA that is universal to all life forms. And that is where the spark of creation really comes from. And it was at this point I decided that this was the only game in town and that I needed to devote my life to psychedelic research. And when I got back, the person who took me to the Mazatec Sierras to introduce me to her said, well, I'm working as a lab tech at a research and development company in Manhattan. I can bring back all kinds of chemical precursors and equipment. And so I said, well, my mother's got a basement she's not using, so
meant to be, huh?
I see a little marriage happening here.
So were you intending to work with psilocybin at that time?
Yes, that was the first thing. I mean, when I went to the Mazatec Sierras to visit her, it was with a lot of foreknowledge of what research had been done, and Albert Hofmann was already one of my great heroes. And after the trip to Guadalupe de Jimenez, where she lived, I was able to understand, you know, the importance of the psychedelic experience, and decided I wanted to start manufacturing psilocybin. Very ambitious project. It's not easy to do. Mm. So we started out, and I was very lucky to be successful for the first three steps on my first go-around, but the starting materials were too expensive. So I just merely substituted the starting material for a much cheaper compound, which would make DMT.
Ah.
And I started to produce large amounts of DMT.
Now, that wasn't that common in the early 60s, DMT. It was quite rare on the streets, wasn't it?
Well, it didn't exist until we started producing it.
Ah.
And that was when, and I started creating circles of people, and we brought them to my little attic temple, and we started turning people on one after another, and created quite a circle of beautiful people. And then Richard Alpert, now Ram Dass, came to talk at Brooklyn College, where I was studying anthropology. Mm-hmm. And he said he'd like to come home and visit with me after we spoke after the lecture. And I said, well, I've got a laboratory I'd like to show you. And then he said, well, you've been guiding all these people with DMT trips, and we're very interested in DMT up at Millbrook. Why don't you come up and work with us there? Mm. And so I became the chief alchemist for the League for Spiritual Discovery. Mm. In our charter, which is religiously incorporated, legally incorporated religion of the state of New York, was the right to use sacraments. And we used them, and we were persecuted for them in contravention of our constitutional rights. Mm. Of course, at that point, the pressure was so heavy for keeping the war in Vietnam going that we were being turned into, you know, some kind of bugaboo, some kind of monsters.
Okay. To go back a step there, I really like your use of the term alchemist, because some of the the great acid cooks, those words aren't grand enough to really describe the higher spiritual leanings of, you know, when someone makes LSD, it's not just a physical chemical reaction. There's spirit imbued, there's the set and setting, and there's really the ether and the subtle vibrations. You know, is there anything you've learnt about that process of being an alchemist?
Absolutely. The process of producing LSD or any transformative substance is in itself a spiritual path. That moment of realization when looking into a cloudy solution and you start to see the creation of rainbow white crystals that emit light on their own accord and outside of the body and inside of the body. It was Bear Owsley who discovered that his highly purified production LSD, which was the first in the world, was piezoluminescent. That means when it was struck in a clear vial in a completely dark room and of sufficient purity, it would flash blue light. And so when I learned that, I began to realize that the light that is produced by these substances is an inward light as well as an outward light that we're perceiving through our sensory perception. It's actually being generated from inside. Mm. And then I went deeper into this with studying ibogaine and found out that that light really comes from DNA.
Mm.
And that the DNA is actually the creative principle in the universe through which we are all propagated universally. And it is also piezoluminescent. And then I discovered later on in the 90s that DMT was also piezoluminescent. Mm. I took a jar of crystals I had just crystallized and banged them in a dark room, and the whole room lit up with this eerie blue fluorescence.
Wow.
So when you are producing these sacraments, and especially the fact that there is a little bit of leakage, especially with LSD, it's very hard to manufacture LSD without becoming affected by it.
Is it in the air particles or
just
in the skin?
Basically, when you isolate it in a very pure form, it becomes a very fine powder, and it can float in the air, and it touches any mucous membrane, and it will be absorbed.
Mm.
And you are on a constant LSD high while you're manufacturing. DMT is a different story. But nevertheless, still, the psychedelic experience and just the creation of the psychedelic substance is a path to enlightenment.
Mm. You were saying before, this is, you know, for you, it's partially also been a religious path. I mean, it's such a spiritual position that you've been holding.
It's
as
mainly
mediated between heaven and earth, really. You're bringing some higher frequencies down. And you were persecuted for that, weren't you? I mean, as part of the whole war on drugs and the legalization of LSD.
There's so much investment in war and misery and the creation of conflict and division, not only in our political systems, but in our nature of conditioning ourselves and our children, that needs to be abandoned for a certain type of divine madness, where one can, in Bob Dylan's words, in Tambourine Man, just be, you know, one hand waving, free dancing, nude on a beach, you know. These acts of ecstatic revelation are healing in themselves. Just so that going through that experience is a healing experience. Joy, love, dance are healing experiences. So this point that Barb Jesse makes about the medicalization, you know, being way too overemphasized, and is basically a pretext for rationalizing people's work, does not fall on deaf ears with me, because that has been my motivation from the very beginning, to bring peace, love, and harmony to the human race, and to stop all this insane misery, torture, and homicide all over the world, and transform this planet. There is no reason, in any way, that this planet is not a paradise for all of us to live and dance and love in. Mm. And that is what this work is all about.
Fantastic. Thank you for your time, and thank you for your great efforts to the psychedelic community, too.
My pleasure. My pleasure. So now I've been bringing in the Brotherhood people, their first year for the first time, and I'm trying to bring in Tim Scully, who was my teacher, who got the teaching from Bear, and Bear then authorized the passing down of this high purity production to authorize for me to learn this.
Yeah, wow.
Because of.
So it's the real psychedelic brotherhood coming back together again.
Yes. So we're trying to get them all start coming out now, because we've all been so tortured, and our children have been perverted by the suffering that we've gone through and the fugitivism we've had to go through. I just ran into Leonard Picard's daughter, and I just said to her with tears in my eyes, I am so sorry, and I apologize for all of the psychedelic manufacturers who have had to abandon their children because we are trying to do a good thing in the world. And I just want you to know, we love you and we never meant to hurt you. But all of the children of the Brotherhood, my child, his children, are all suffering greatly because of the persecution to their fathers. And
I think they probably feel bad about it. I know they feel bad about it. I know they're all suffering.
Cultural sacrifice on this, yeah.
Well, but it was cultural sacrifice that we made at their expense.
Against the authorities.
We've already been involved in the childbearing process when the importance of this mission, you know, became more and more poignant.
It's a part of their path, too. And they chose their path.
Ultimately,
they
yeah.
will choose our path, so they, on some level, they chose this path, and it's part of their path, and they can be empowering.
Exactly. But they have to accept that, and they're not accepting that yet.
They will.
But they're four, just getting to their 40s now. They're coming out of the terrible 30s, and they may be able to like snap to the fact that they, you know, grew up in a very blessed situation.
Probably has to do with personal issues that are unresolved more than political.
I think that's
about the political cause of personal issues.
Very.
You know, I think it's really beautiful that the elders are coming back, because that's what the disconnect for so many decades there was, that the 60th generation that dispersed. And then the yuppies in the 80s and a lot of the bulk.
We didn't disperse, we were driven into anonymity and into
40 years in the desert, huh?
Yeah. Exactly.
yeah.
40 years.
And now the promised land's on the horizon.
Yeah, that's what we've all been working for, the promised land. And
yeah.
I got out clean by just some act of God. Without having to compromise any of my principles, I got out with only doing a total of 6 years.
Wow.
A lot of skillful game playing and pre-thought about how I was going to handle my arrest, when and if it ever came again. And we were lucky to prevail. Mm. But Len Picard's doing two life sentences.
He took a fall, Bouchera, yeah.
And that's horrible. Two consecutive life sentences. There's no chance.
Is he still in jail?
Yeah.
He's in one of those like horrible supermax prisons, and he's like a gentle, urbane, extremely intelligent man.
Are the Black Panthers still around? Maybe we need another liberation mission.
Actually, you know, it was very funny because in prison, I was in an intake unit, which is where the fish first come. Fish is a term that means a new. Inmate that arrives, and they're usually ripped off and robbed, and their new issue taken, you know, their new boots and stuff like that. If you don't know things about when you take your boots off at night, you lift up the whole double bed and you put the boot into one foot and you take the other boot. So if anybody tries to steal your boots, you know, you can feel them try to lift your bed at night.
That's great.
Stop them, right?
Yeah.
So this is the kind of stuff that was going on in the intake unit. And I found it kind of like boring. And I heard that in the medical unit, and I was getting to be a little elderly at this point, in my 50s, I said to the head, the case manager for the unit, that you have empty beds in the medical unit. I'm elderly and I have medical issues, so why don't you put me in there? Because you got empty beds and I want to get out of the intake unit. He said, you want to go into the medical unit? Fine. So I was put into the only bed that was available on a permanent basis, and the other bed was with this gorilla who was in for about 200,000 years, big black guy, really nasty. And I had taken the bed of a guy named Charlie who was thrown into the hole. And Charlie was another black guy, and he was a Black Panther. But when he got out of the hole, the gorilla said to me, you get down out of the upper bunk and go into the lower bunk. That's his bunk, and you don't get that bunk. It was the other way around. And I said, yeah, no problem. Don't worry about it. It's not a big deal. And Charlie came out, and I gave him his bed back. And we got to talking, and he said, oh, you're the guy that made Orange Sunshine. I got to be Timothy Leary's chauffeur when he came to Watts and visited the Black Panther, and we took gas and drove all over, and the gorilla starts to turn around and look, and he says, you mean you're one of the original flower children? And so now all of a sudden, the worst, toughest blacks in the whole prison are now walking and saying, "Oh, flower child, flower child." And it's like, and the same thing happened with the Mexicans and with the white supremacists and the Nazis. And I made friends with everyone, and I started teaching yoga to the guards that had back problems.
Beautiful.
So I got out really fast and lucky. Mm. I told them I wasn't going to make any problems for them, and I never did. Mm. But I never did anything I was supposed to do. I took care of the roses, I did yoga, and I wrote books and articles.
This is Dharma. This is downtime.
I decided to change the framework I was in from a prison to a Buddhist monastery where I could be writing my scrolls and practicing, you know, my physical discipline.
Yeah, right.
And I did that. And that's about 20 minutes of work a week I had. Yeah. Got a good job.
It's pretty good.
Weekend orderly.
Yeah.
One sweep down the main line and it's done for the week.
Excellent.
And the rest of the time I did 2 or 3 hours of yoga, 2 or 3 hours of walking, and 2 or 3 hours of writing every day. So.
There are worse things, eh?
Yeah.
Did well.
It wasn't bad.
Yeah.
Three hots in a cot, three places to write. It wasn't bad.
Okay. Well, that's very good. Congratulations.
It all depends on your attitude.
Yeah.
Wherever you are. There you are.
And that's why you got out sooner, because you had a better attitude.
Well, you know, it was interesting. At that time, Usha, tall woman you saw, who's my partner, is a spiritualist of many, many decades, and kicked the traces and went to India. And she has confronted and worked with many of the greatest gurus. And she was, in fact, the person who organized Eckhart Tolle's first talk in London. And then she was indicted with me in the conspiracy trial up in Canada for the lab we had outside of Vancouver. And... so she came.
I told you that you got out sooner because you had a better answer.
Yes, thank you. And so she came up and started helping Eckhart with his work in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And sending me in his works, which I read. I read Power of Now 9 times. Totally freed me. It's wonderful.
It was good. But do you think Eckhart's done LSD?
What?
Has Eckhart done LSD?
Is that he? Is he
Eckhart Tolle?
Does he take an LSD? I don't think so.
Doesn't need it.
No, I don't think so. He's a scholar who came through the path of Gyani, the path of the mind. She was giving passing messages back and forth between Eckhart and myself while I was in prison, and I wrote him a letter where I expressed how I felt about what was going on and how I was dealing with the situation. And he read the letter to the group that he was working with, and he said, "This man is going to get out of prison much earlier than he thinks, because he's totally surrendered."
Yeah, once you surrender to it,
and I had already received my parole date, and it was for a year later, and it was already written in stone. And the fact that I had even gotten one for a year later was fantastic. And when it came through from Washington, there was a sentence correction, and they took another year off. And so when the decision to grant me parole came back from Washington, my sentence computation dropped a year, and they had to really scramble hard to get me out legally in time without giving me a false arrest in prison. But I was already ordered out.
Wow.
Go with the flow, hey?
Yeah. And they like to do things at their own speed. You know? So he was absolutely right. And I called up my parole consultant who worked with the U.S. Federal Parole Commission for 20 years. And I said, What's this all about? Is this a mistake, you know? And she said, "I'm mystified. I've never seen this happen before. But the only thing it must be is because they did the sentence computation on your bail jumping thing, which was dismissed, and that took a year off your sentence."
Maybe Eckhart pulled some strings.
And
well.
Well, it's probably on other levels.
Yeah, I know.
Actually, what?
Just quickly, what do you think of the quality of acid these days, and is it actually being micromanaged to be diluted to not be such a, you know, a revolutionary chemical? Do you think it's like 100 mics or 80 mics or even less? It's not.
It surely works for me.
Well, I know, but I mean, there's the 60 doses, which was like not just mind blowing, but soul blowing.
Or
was it the set and setting of the times that also created that energy? Or is the sacrament itself more diluted and genericized by the business these days?
Are the doses any different now?
Yeah, they are.
Dosage has always been very variable and based on the ego of the manufacturer.
On what?
The ego of the manufacturer, what their ambitions and expectations are, and what they expect to get done, whether their intentions are financial capitalization and exploitation, or if their goals are transformation for the human race.
Well, if anything, and that'd probably be weaker if it was a greedy person making them. That'd probably be weaker.
Exactly.
Didn't Berousley sort of set the tone with 250 mics, but it was sort of an accident or something?
It was 200 mics.
200 mics.
What's the standard dose?
There is no standard dose.
No? But what's your standard dose?
Well,
orange sunshine. Yes.
I had different standard doses. My first standard doses were distributing the LSD I got from Ram Dass that came from Czechoslovakia, and those were made into 200 microgram sugar cubes. And that was in the early 60s. And then Alza came out with its, I think they were 200 mics, maybe it was 250. But the difference, and this is something that's really important, is that the whole alchemical work of transformation of substance into something of a higher nature is the alchemical process. And Owsley was totally into this. I was into it. Owsley was a great inspiration to me because he was the one that really kicked me in the ass about purity. And he brought the purity of all of my stuff way up.
Wow.
And he was a great inspiration to me. And because of that, he allowed Tim to teach me his method for making LSD, which was piezoluminescent purity. And the LSD, you know, has two factors that affect how it affects people. One is its purity. If it's very clear and very clean acid, you'll have a very clean and clear experience. Acid is a magnifying intensifier.
Yeah.
DMT and psilocybin are weavers. They're weavers of spiritual things. So they don't give you a lot of energy. Enough energy, but not that much. Acid gives you an overage of energy. And it also is this magnifying intensifier. So any impurities come. So 100 is good for learning about yourself and having a good time. 200, you begin to move into the hallucinatory and self-transformative. And 300, you go into complete self-transformation levels.
Wow.
And so that's why we did the 300 one. It was an experiment, but we thought, well, maybe more is better.
Yeah, how did the culture react?
Well, I didn't know for like 20, 30 years because I became a fugitive. It had such a powerful effect. Stopped the Vietnam War, mobilized Washington against me, you know, like flies on dog shit. And I had to leave the country.
Wow.
And
that's what 300 mics does. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, well, we put out about 250 billion doses.
That's exactly what I think.
A quarter of a billion doses.
Well, they did levitate the Pentagon, didn't they, with that much acid in the bloodstream.
You did?
Nixon set the dogs after us and started the war on drugs. And
he used
to go to a little cafe, a little white house in
can we get this on camera?
Point Dana in Southern California near his home in San Clemente. And they were all surfers that worked in this place. And they'd serve breakfast and lunch for them, and they'd jump and catch the waves and stuff. And one of them got sick one day, and one of the Brotherhood guys switched places with him and put a
sugar bowl laced with LSD at Nixon's table. And Nixon seemed a bit disturbed after breakfast and was very hastily and speedily bundled into the car and whisked off to his home.
It's classic. It'd be great to get those audio takes from the White House Freedom of Information Act.
Really?
Nixon tripping rap. Let's try to narrow down
what
the date of that.
On such a day, Point Dana, when Richard Nixon became ill during.
Do you know when you did it? Do you know the date?
You've got some great stories and great history. Yeah. Thanks
that's
for sharing.
Amazing. Thank you so much. I really respect the people who make the medicine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well.
So we all rely on you.
It's a tough job, you know.
I know, right?
It's a dirty job, but someone's got to do it.
That's it. All right.
Yeah, most of the people who've done it are pretty well scarred by it.
Oh.